This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, December 15th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. At a press conference over the summer, when the issue of Russia's hacking into the computers of the DNC was first making news, Donald Trump had this to say.
What do I have to get involved with Putin for? I have nothing to do with Putin. I've never spoken to him. I don't know anything about him other than he will respect me. He doesn't respect our president. And if it is Russia, which is probably not, nobody knows who it is, but if it is Russia, it's really bad for a different reason, because it shows how little respect they have for our country when they would hack into a major party and get everything. But it would be interesting to see. I will tell you this. Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing. I think you will probably be rewarded mightily by our press.
This week, Senator John McCain described the Russian cyber attacks, which included Republicans, by the way, as well as Democrats, as a possible act of war. Joshua Yaffa joins me from Moscow to discuss the view from there. Hey, Josh.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So, just to review, in October, the FBI concluded that Russia was behind the hacks and subsequent leaks of the Democratic Party emails. Last Friday, the CIA went further, claiming that Putin's intent was to help Trump. How does that look to you from where you're sitting?
It doesn't seem like the facts of the matter have necessarily changed. In other words, what the U.S. Seems to know about the nature of Russian hacking, that has remained relatively constant. What seems to be new is this the new tinge to the CIA analysis, which was adding this new veneer of intent or motive to the Russian actions. And all of that, I think, ultimately is much more of a political issue for Washington to come to terms with and discuss what does that mean for this election that just passed and what does that mean for elections going forward. But in terms of the changes in the story, I think they've been much more Washington-based changes in the past couple weeks than they have been Moscow ones.
Yes, and you have said that Putin was surprised by Trump's victory, like the rest of the world, by the way. So what was the goal? What were the Russians after here?
The real answer is, of course, we don't know now and likely we'll never know. But my best guess is that the Russians wanted to essentially mess with us, a kind of, you know, internet trolling brought to life to introduce a measure of chaos, doubt to the election process, to tinge the entire affair with a note of illegitimacy, expecting that Clinton would be the ultimate victor in this presidential election. I think it's telling to look at some of the state propaganda here in Russia. The last week before the election, on the program of a television host named Dmitry Kiselyov, who really represents the kind of dark id of the Kremlin propaganda machine, he was talking with great hysterics, not about what a great candidate Trump was, but of talking about how whoever won the presidency was going to enter office from day one, as he said, facing impeachment hearings, and that the entire legitimacy of the American political system was in doubt after such a dirty and foul campaign.
Given what we know about Putin's past in particular, he was a KGB past, and his record as president, this shouldn't have come as a surprise. But just take us back briefly to the Cold War era and how Russian intelligence worked then to undermine the West and how this fits into that pattern.
Well, I think what is new about this current moment is the degree of direct intervention. If U.S. intelligence services and the private cybersecurity companies who come to this assessment about Russian involvement are correct, the degree of direct Russian involvement in a presidential election is essentially unprecedented. And that's partly to do really with the state of the world now. It's a much different world than it was in the Cold War. And that's certainly an environment that Putin especially is very adept at making the most of, the waning influence of traditional media, the waning influence of establishment political parties and movements, just the real deflation of the power and influence of all of these elite establishment institutions has created a playing field that's really advantageous for Putin. But I think it's important to keep in mind that he's not the architect of these changes. We are creating this mess for ourselves.
Yeah, you know, there was a great piece in the Times this week, a big investigation about the entire affair, sort of how this has unfolded. And one of the interesting things the reporters pointed out was how Putin managed to turn two institutions that are at the very core of American democracy, political campaigns and the press, the independent media, to his own ends. They cite the media's appetite for the hacked material and the focus on the gossipy content, thereby missing one of the biggest stories of our lifetime, which is Russia interfering with an American election.
You're right in pointing out that the nature of American society as it exists circa 2016, an essentially open liberal democracy, a postmodern one, it's a much more open, anarchic playing field, that there aren't necessarily easy or obvious defenses against the kind of thing that the Russians apparently did. You know, there really isn't a lot you can do to create some sort of stopgap against that kind of infiltration. It's much easier to do, paradoxically or interestingly, in a place like Putin's Russia that doesn't have these anarchic institutions like a free press or independent political movements and parties. It's just an environment that I think is very tricky to protect against, and maybe you don't even want to protect against fully, right? Because it would mean you would be eliminating a lot of the good bacteria along with the bad. It's clear that policymakers in Washington don't really have a handle on what, if anything, it is they can do to counteract these kinds of interventions. And is this essentially the new normal for elections going forward?
Trump seems to have taken a number of pages from Putin's playbook. You know, there's a lot of talk here about the dangerous effects of fake news, which are suddenly so manifest, and also played a role in this election. Trump dismisses the CIA's finding as a conspiracy theory, he himself being the master spinner of conspiracy theories. And these two are techniques that, you know, masterful propagandists have perfected over many, many decades.
What's certainly interesting, in fact, maybe the most interesting thing for me to observe from here in Moscow, in the way that this presidential election has kind of turned us all into Russians of one flavor or another. You've talked about the similarities in style between Trump and Putin, but I think it's also worth spending some time and looking at the way the American political establishment on both sides of the aisle and in both parties has taken on some traditional Russian attributes in responding to this election and responding to the notion of Russian interference in this election, which is, if summed up in one sentence, to downplay or purposely overlook internal domestic social and political factors while grasping for a grand explanatory narrative based on some outside foreign hand. That's something that undergirds much of the Putin narrative and the Putin propaganda machine about what happens inside Russia, seeing the nefarious hand of the West, and in particular America, everywhere, and giving America much an outsized role, not just in Russia's domestic affairs, but really in throughout the world.
When you say that we are in the same way overlooking internal factors, what are you referring to exactly over here, and how does that relate to what you see in Russia?
There are a whole host of factors endemic to America about the shifts we're still only beginning to understand in American politics and society, a rejection of a certain establishment politics that has governed the country for generations. Yeah. Just like in Russia, so many in the Russian political class would like to downplay some of the homegrown reasons for Russia's problems, the decline of its economy, whatever the case may be, and point the finger at America. I see some in the American political class doing the same thing with Russia, rather than coming to terms with what was it that happened inside the American electorate that led people to choose, essentially, Trump. There's this search for the outside external hand.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
It's hard to imagine any foreign leader being happier these days, given Trump's talk throughout the campaign about recognizing Russia's annexation of Crimea, his criticisms of NATO, and, his open adulation of Putin himself. But we're already hearing from the hawks on Capitol Hill. As I mentioned at the top, John McCain and others are, you know, launching investigations into the hacking business. And they are, of course, at least as alarmed as Democrats are about Russian meddling. How sophisticated is Putin's understanding of the American checks on presidential power?
I think not very. I mean, certainly Putin is no dummy, and I wouldn't want to paint him at all as a naive politician. He's proved over and over again that he's a pretty savvy one. But I do think the Russians, Putin, those around him, those in the Russian political class, suffer from a bit of projection bias, and that they overestimate the role of the executive because in Russia, again, the role of the executive is so decisive as to be almost omnipotent, at least in certain spheres of policy. And I think looking across the Atlantic at Washington, oftentimes Russian policymakers overweight the degree to which a president can or does play a decisive role in a range of policy questions, including policy toward Russia. So I think it's not exactly like they're setting off firecrackers in the street. I think they're intrigued, excited, pleased at, again, what for them was the surprise election of Trump. They certainly see him as someone who is going to be much more favorable and sympathetic to their interests than Clinton. We can already see that with the appointment of Rex Tillerson, the former head of ExxonMobil, someone who's been on the record and quite public in his sympathies for Russia. Nonetheless, I think that they don't quite fully internalize or understand the extent to which there are all these other forces in the American political system. The American political system is such a complex, diverse, at times anarchic place.
Well, and Tillerson, among other Trump appointees, is going to have some very tough confirmation hearings. So that's going to be interesting to watch.
And the Russians will be watching it closely. For them, I think that's a very important and telling appointment. As I said, Tillerson has especially close ties with Igor Sechin, a longtime confidant and close ally of Putin, who now runs Russia's largest oil company, Rosneft, and having Tillerson in place would really signal to the Russians that the Trump administration is going to be essentially what it promised on the international stage. That is, an administration that thinks of everything in terms of the deal. Ultimately, Putin's vision of the world, which he's essentially made clear in so many words, is he wants to sit down with an American president at a table, maybe quite literally take out a map and put it on the table and take out two Sharpies and divide up the world and divide up spheres of influence and say, here's who gets what. And in Trump, they see an American president who, more than any president in recent memory, is potentially ready to make that kind of deal, whether literally or in some metaphorical form.
Some of our colleagues who've been reporting from Russia and other authoritarian regimes have been warning about the dangers of a figure like Trump and the fragility of democracy. How worried are you?
Well, so far, in his personality and his behavior and in the approach toward the power of this one man, we do see a lot of authoritarian strongman tendencies. In other words, Trump himself clearly would very much like to be the kind of executive we see in places like Russia and elsewhere, a leader to whom other institutions of governance are essentially subservient and turned into instruments of executive power. The question, or really the test for America, will be how strong, how resilient are those institutions, and really how important is the survival of those institutions to voters, to the electorate? How much are people, not just press, not just those in the political class, but how much are Americans going to be paying attention and animated and excited and motivated, Trump voters or not, to make sure that those institutions survive? Because the tipping point, it seems like, in authoritarian systems is when the executive gets control over those other institutions and gains levers of influence and power over institutions that on paper nominally should be independent. That hasn't really happened yet, but if we get close to that, I think that's when we can really start to worry. And preventing that from happening, I think, is really the great task of the years forward.
Yeah, and we're in the recrimination stage right now. And there's been some criticism of the Obama administration from people who admire him for not strenuously objecting to the Russian hacking before the election. And yet you wonder, what could he have done? What would Putin have responded to?
That's exactly the question I've been trying to get a handle on, really going back for months, back to the summer when these allegations first surfaced. And certainly now, again, as there's a renewed call in Washington for Obama to do something. But it's hard to get a handle on what that something really could be. There were these leaks from the Panama Papers that connected various oligarchs and businessmen to a string of offshore accounts that supposedly held some wealth potentially at Putin's disposal. It was a story that in another political system could have been quite damaging, but it was really a non-event here in Russia, really because I think there's already such a degree of cynical expectation of government corruption among the Russian population that any more evidence isn't really going to convince anyone who isn't already been convinced, or really no one expects anything different. There's talk of kind of retributive cyber attacks against Russian cyber infrastructure or real infrastructure. It's harder to judge. That all depends really on what the Obama administration would be willing to do, how far it would be willing to go. I mean, you can only do so much covertly or privately. If you begin to inflict real damage, that becomes quite public, and you potentially create a much bigger crisis. And if anything, we've learned from the Obama administration, they seem to be crisis diffusers rather than crisis stokers. So it doesn't really seem in keeping with the Obama administration we've come to know over 8 years. In sum, that just leaves not a lot of great decisive options, as I see it, for the Obama administration to respond. They're certainly under a lot of pressure to do so, but I don't see an obvious, ready-to-go policy response that they could just put into place quickly.
How damaging have the sanctions been? That's something that both Trump and Tillerson have talked very strongly about lifting.
The sanctions have been impactful for particular individuals and particular companies. Arguably, you could say the largest effect on the Russian people actually came from the counter sanctions Putin imposed, in which he banned the import of certain foodstuffs from Europe and the United States, which led to an inflation in food prices, which is the thing that probably hit the average Russian the most. But the Russian economy is not doing well. It's in, I don't know, the second year, I think, in a row of recession, unclear when, if or when growth will return. And certainly the Russian budget is taking a hit. There's belt tightening going on across the Russian government, and there's almost no area of Russian budgetary spending that hasn't seen some decrease over the past year. But that has a lot more to do with the collapse in global oil prices and the general structural inefficiencies in the Russian economy that have to do with the avoidance of reform for the past 10 or 20 years, the end essentially of the oil-fueled growth model and the inability or unwillingness to come up with a new model. Those are much more decisive, important factors in explaining why Russia is in the middle of a deepening recession more than the sanctions. The sanctions certainly don't help, but they're not factor number one.
One of the most horrifying stories in the world is underway right now. This week, after a final joint offensive by Syria and Russia, Aleppo fell to the Assad regime, with the regime slaughtering its own citizens. It's just almost unimaginable what we've been seeing. So this has enormous geostrategic ramifications. Talk about what Putin has in mind in the region and how he'd like to take advantage of the support of the incoming U.S. commander-in-chief.
However horrifying, inhuman this final push in Aleppo has been, I think it's essentially in line with Putin's larger vision for how he would like the Syrian conflict to play out. It now seems like with Aleppo in regime hands and with Donald Trump ascendant in the U.S. presidency, any talk of forcing Bashar al-Assad from power as some kind of precondition or first stage in negotiations seems pretty moot at this point, and that's certainly been a priority of Putin's all along. I think it's worth noting not because he has a particularly soft spot for Assad or considers him a friend or an ally, but really he has this obsession, I think, at this point against anything that looks or smells or in any way resembles U.S.-led regime change. That's his nightmare and bête noire scenario wherever it appears in the world. And Syria was a place where he was going to mount a kind of last stand to make sure there was no repeat of a Libya-style scenario in which Gaddafi was overthrown and chaos ensued. So from Putin's perspective, I think Syria is heading in the trajectory that really he wanted, with Trump, in a sense, echoing the Russian position, saying ISIS is enemy number one. If Assad is fighting ISIS, that means at minimum we shouldn't be ourselves fighting Assad. At most, maybe we should be acquiescing to Assad's rule or making some kind of alliance with him. It really seems like the Syrian conflict is shaping up, as I said, more or less in the way that Putin hoped or intended when he put the Russian Air Force into Syria last year.
Thank you so much, Josh.
Thank you.
Joshua Yaffa is a journalist based in Russia. He contributes to The New Yorker and is a fellow at the New America Foundation. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. You can find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com or on the New Yorker Today app, a great way to read The New Yorker on your mobile device, available at no extra charge from the App Store or at NewYorker.com/today. Tell us what you thought about this podcast. Rate and review The Political Scene on iTunes. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron for NewYorker.com. We'll be off next week. Have a good holiday. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.